This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to our weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker. With me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, apparently the British people really do want to get Brexit done. Another election in Britain this week, and it handed Boris Johnson and the Conservatives a huge victory and a strong mandate to carry out what they asked for in 2016 to separate Britain from the European Union. Richard is pulling double duty today after talking about this with Stephen Fleury on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. He's here to tell us about it now. Over to you, Richard.
Yes, really a shocking result in some ways, though I guess some polls indicated it could happen, but not just a victory for Conservative leader Boris Johnson, but a landslide, an overwhelming victory. The greatest Conservative majority in my lifetime. You know, this is the biggest Conservative win since 1987. For Labour, it was their biggest defeat since 1935. And one of the things that makes this vote so historic is you've got a whole load of constituencies up in the north of England that are stronghold Labour areas that have been Labour constituencies. In some places, they've returned a Labour leader every election since before World War II. I think there are even some places that haven't voted Conservative in 100 years that voted Conservative in this election. It just redrew the political map. You know, if anything, the left and Labour kind of maybe made some gains within London. But outside of the kind of the metropolitan elite, just a massive swing to the Conservatives. And I think it could be easy to underestimate what we saw yesterday, especially if you're not from the UK. You're kind of like, well, Britain's had a Conservative government for 9 years. Boris Johnson was Prime Minister. Mr. Johnson is now going to remain Prime Minister. So things just stay the same. I mean, okay, there was this radical Marxist with anti-Semitic leanings, Jeremy Corbyn, that was kept out of 10 Downing Street, and that's significant. But overall, nothing much is going to change. But that's not true. This is going to be different. We're in a different Conservative government territory now than we've ever been in, like I said, in my lifetime. This is the first time in my lifetime that we have a Conservative government that actually has a significant majority in Parliament. All these other ones, Mr. Cameron, for his first term was in coalition with the Liberal Democrats. Afterwards, he still didn't have a particularly comfortable majority. Now, Mr. Johnson has got something a little under 80. So before, just a handful of Conservatives could say, we don't like this law. We're blocking it. And especially those on the left wing of the party. And there used to be quite a lot on the left wing of the party. Mr. Johnson's had even a bit of a purge before the election. They could say, nah, this is too conservative for us. We're blocking it. That can't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. Now that he's got a majority of 80, he's secure from those kind of threats. And he's also secure from this kind of thing where just a few people could change sides or the government could get deadlocked and we'd have to go to a fresh election 1-2 years into the term. You know, that's not the case anymore. He's just about certainly set now for a 5-year term, full term in government. There's just about nothing that could force early elections. So we've got a much more stable government than we've seen for a long time in Britain and a much more powerful prime minister than we've seen for a long time in Britain.
Just to put things in the larger context with Britain leaving the European Union, that's really what he staked this entire election on. He made that his campaign slogan. It was really the one issue that he put above all others, get Brexit done. The British people say resoundingly, we agree with you. Yes, this is what we want. Why is this so significant? And it really does look like this is going to go through, that he's inoculated from all of those threats that he's been facing all of this time, the stonewalling and blockades. When Brexit first happened, we put that in the prophetic context of what Herbert W. Armstrong had said and how it's just so significant that Britain is separating itself. It looks like that's going to happen. Give us that prophetic context.
Yeah, I mean, people are talking about it now pretty much being a certainty that we're going to be out of the European Union by the end of the month, or maybe by the end of next month, which, I mean, given how much this has dragged on and how many deadlines we've passed, that feels almost unbelievable. I don't think that sunk in for me that in a month's time, we are not going to be part of the European Union, that the result of the referendum will finally be implemented. But if you go back, you look what Herbert W. Armstrong was writing about the European Union and Britain's place in it. It is really remarkable. You know, 1945, just as World War II was ending, he was forecasting that Germany would rise again inside a, quote, European Union. That exact term. And he described something that would start out as an economic union first and gain power that way before becoming something much more integrated. And he said, right from those early days of that European Union coming together, Britain will be no part of it. That they're not going to be part of this finally formed united Europe that's coming. When Britain joined in 1973, he wrote that they're going to regret that. He said that date that they joined was a date fraught with ominous potentialities. Writing in 1985, right before he died, he talked about how the common market was going to transform into a kind of United States of Europe, and he said Britain will not be in that empire soon to come. Referring to that much more closely integrated United States of Europe. So he said that for years, and then after he died, we picked up the baton. We were saying the same message. They're not going to be part of this coming European power. And that's, next month, that's what's going to happen. We'll be out of there. And we were making those forecasts. Mr. Armstrong was making those forecasts based on Bible prophecy, based on the fact that the Bible talks about this power coming together, and it talks about God raising up this power within Europe as really something to punish Britain and America. So, when you understand that Bible prophecy, well, then of course Britain's going to regret joining it. And, well, of course, they're not going to be part of those final 10 Union of Nations that God is raising up to punish Britain. So based on those prophecies, you're just seeing this play out now throughout our headlines, and you can pretty much put the fulfilled stamp on that. I mean, maybe wait till it actually happens towards the end of the month, but I mean, it's clear Britain's not going to be part of that superpower. That's done.
Yeah. Well, the other aspect of this that is just so fascinating is we've followed the trend of the linkage between what's happening politically in Britain, America, and Israel, all three of these nations facing these kind of existential threats to the established order. We've talked about a deep state in Britain. You wrote about that. We have an article about that in our last print edition of the Trumpet magazine. This is a firm go back to your seat kind of a message that the British people are sending to that deep state in Britain. You can't help but project and wonder, what does this mean for Israel? We're going to talk about them having another election next spring later in the program. Of course, America is in its election cycle, and we're looking ahead to next November as Donald Trump faces impeachment. It seems like, just looking at this from a broader prophetic standpoint, that this could very well portend more of those types of results in those other nations as well. Brexit in 2016 predated the Trump victory later that November. That could be what happens this time as well.
I think that's fascinating. I mean, this is, I don't want to underestimate the resilience of that deep state.
That's true.
But this does really look like total victory for Mr. Johnson for Brexit. I mean, it was Andrew Marr, I think, on one of the election programs I was watching this morning. He talked about how it's kind of like a new people's revolt against the metropolitan elite. And with that majority in parliament, it seems like there's nothing anyone can do now to stop Mr. Johnson. And as I wrote in that article, you look at who's been against Brexit. And even in this election, you had a former Conservative Prime Minister, John Major, say don't vote for Boris Johnson because he was desperate to stop Brexit. And you've had all of the media, all of the or just about all of the elites in business, at least all the TV media, all of these elites across all of these different areas, and it looks like a total defeat. And you know, in August of this year, Mr. Flurry had an article, Can President Trump Get Control of His Own Divided Government? Mm-hmm. And he was pointing to some of these prophecies that indicated that you would have a strong leader within the United States who would bring a resurgence and kind of have centralize a lot of power within the United States. And he talked about how Britain and Israel would be following those same kind of trends. You know, well, if you think about somebody getting control of their own government, I think that's exactly what happened with Boris Johnson yesterday. And as Mr. Flurry talked about in that article, well, the Bible indicates that that's what that Mr. Trump is going to have complete control over his own divided government. I think he's already gone some way towards that. And yeah, maybe this is a presaging some of that happening in the United States as well.
Yeah, what Gerald Flurry has been saying about this is based on that history that is prophecy in 2 Kings, where Jeroboam became king over Israel at a time when it was really dropping, that there was a real decline within the nation, and then there was this resurgence, that God saved the nation through this unrighteous king. That resurgence really is—it's definitely been evident in a broad way under President Trump. This seems like this could very well lead to a similar type of resurgence, even quite quickly in Britain.
Yes, I mean, if we get out of the European Union, I think that there's all kinds of potential getting control of our own laws, our own economy. But just even in the last few hours, after these results have come in, the pound has soared up 3% almost to a 19-month high. The graphs on the pound are almost hilarious. I was watching those kind of like right after the exit poll came out at 10 o'clock last night, local time, showing that the Conservatives were forecast to win a big majority. It just went through the roof, the pound. The graph just kind of goes straight up. But then even the FTSE 250 stock index, so one of the big stock index, that's jumped. It's got its biggest jump in a decade as investors come right back in to the UK after fearing that maybe you'd have a far left government. There's one at Questor, one kind of investment firm that's forecasting a 10% surge on the stock market by the end of the year. So you're already seeing a financial resurgence just today. Now, I think it's important to point out that this is a temporary mm-hmm. resurgence. But it's still something that's important to note. You know, God is—he prophesied that he could turn this around, that he would turn this around. There are prophecies about Britain's role in Europe as well, and he's showing us. Look, you know, if you turn to me, and if you repent of your sins, well, I can bless you and turn this around, and you can make this resurgence can be permanent.
Right.
But just to have some of that resurgence in one day is remarkable.
Well, we will definitely put a link to that article from Gerald Flurry in the show notes, Can President Trump Get Control of His Own Divided Government? I think that was a very good point that you made. But also, Richard has written an article, Boris Johnson Wins Big in Britain, What's Next? That is headlining thetrumpet.com today. Go check that out at the website and take a look at a little bit more of the prophetic context of what's going on there in Britain. And we appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard, pulling double duty today. I suppose this next story is predictable, given everything that we've seen happening in the U.S. right now. We talked about, Richard mentioned just the resilience of the deep state. There are people who are saying that the real reason for Boris Johnson's election victory is Russia. And some of the people making this accusation are remarkably familiar. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right, yeah, there are definitely those in Britain's bureaucracy and other places who oppose Boris Johnson, and to undermine him, they've decided to try a brand new strategy that's never been tried before, an attempt to slur Mr. Johnson as a Russian agent. There was an article in the Guardian, I think it was today, talking about how we need a Mueller investigation in Britain. And a month ago, The Guardian published an article. Apparently, they've seen a secret report from British intelligence services that says that the Russians spent 5 years cultivating Tory leaders, including Johnson. this 50-page dossier from the UK's Intelligence and Security Committee is based on analysis from British intelligence agencies as well as third-party experts such as former MI6 officer Christopher Steele. So you've been following this program for anyone of time. Know Christopher Steele is the former British intelligence officer that the Hillary Clinton campaign hired to produce a dossier of rumors, unverified rumors, that Donald Trump was a Russian agent. And actually, on November 12th, Hillary Clinton herself gave an interview with the BBC talking about how shameful it is that Britain's government hasn't made this this 50-page dossier public yet, like the renowned journalist at BuzzFeed did here in the United States, publishing Christopher Steele's other dossier public in America. So you can definitely see that the deep state in Britain's using the same tactics as the deep state in the United States. In this case, actually basing all the intelligence on the campaign against Johnson, the campaign against Trump, the Mueller investigation, the impeachment proceedings. It pretty much all traces back to this one British intelligence agent, Christopher Steele, and whoever he knows in Russia that's feeding him this stuff.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this plays out, because I can't imagine that there's a tremendous appetite in Britain for this type of story, that the fact that The Guardian would be coming out with this, given the historic scale of the Conservative victory, I would imagine would spark a lot of eye rolling by the British people. But like Richard said, you just can't discount the fact that these folks do have a very strong determination to find a way to reclaim power, if there's any possible way that they can do it. If people want more information about this, this is obviously, I mean, it's in a sense, it's laughable, but in another sense, it really is a very serious issue that is prevalent in Britain and in America. For more prophetic context of why we're following that story so closely, where would you send people?
Oh, we've got an article we can put in the show notes by Mr. Stephen Fleury titled "The U.S. Government is at War with Itself." It's a pretty comprehensive account of exactly what is the Steele dossier, how did the radical left use it to try to undermine President Trump, and why that's prophetically significant. It's a little bit of an older article, not by now, but that gives you really the best context, as if that the Guardian's quoting Christopher Steele for their intelligence reports. This is what he did and why he's not credible.
Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. As I said, we've been following how Britain, America, and Israel have all been tracking in the same direction politically, these three nations linked in biblical prophecy. Well, as Britain scores this major conservative victory, we'll take a quick look at the development in Israel this week, where it became official the nation will hold its third election in less than a year. For this, we'll go to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
The current Israeli Knesset had till 12 p.m. on 12 a.m. I suppose it is, on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, to try and cobble together a coalition, but it has not worked. And so, as you said, March 2nd is the date for the new election in Israel. Now, there's a lot of people upset by this, that here we are, have Israel facing all the threats it has, including Iran and the dangerous pressure that Iran is pushing on Israel with its nuclear program and its funding of terrorism. And yet Israel can't come together to produce a government, and they can't take advantage of a pro-American administration right now as well. The law is very uncertain as to whether the prime minister right now has the opportunity in this interim to make massive changes, such as annexing the West Bank, that some of them want him to do, that the U.S. government might be supportive of. All these things that Israel wants to do to take advantage of the Trump tide, as we call it, they cannot really enact because it is in this state of limbo. But there is the light at the end of the tunnel, it seems. March 2nd, people are hoping that there may be a definitive answer at that point, and that there would be a government that can come out of it then.
So I guess the big change from the last election to this coming election is these corruption charges that have been brought against Benjamin Netanyahu. Maybe you can just talk about how that influences the Israeli electorate.
There was a piece in Times of Israel that kind of speaks to that. This is written by its editor-in-chief, David Horowitz. The article is entitled, "Why Israel's Third Election Might Not Be Such a Disaster After All." And he's basically saying in this piece that for the first two elections, we didn't really know about whether Netanyahu was guilty. We had these potential charges of bribery and breach of trust and corruption against him. But now, in this third election, or before this third election, that has become clear. The Attorney General has charged the Prime Minister. And so Israel can go into this election knowing that, without a doubt, we have something more definitive here in terms of whether we have a corrupt leader or not. And he is somebody that wants Netanyahu to be gone, this editor. It seems it's very hard to find somebody that wants Netanyahu to stay. And so he thinks that the Israeli electorate is going to come on board and vote out Mr. Netanyahu when we come to the election. Now, the great irony of this piece even is that there is no real, we haven't seen any change in the swell of support for Mr. Netanyahu even after the Attorney General's decision. And perhaps during these next 3 or 4 months, there might be more that comes out to show that the Attorney General and this process against the Prime Minister has been corrupt. And so the election might actually be decisive the other way. It might actually show that there is a bulk of Israeli civilians that don't believe that Mr. Netanyahu is guilty. And if that happens, and there will be no healing of the rift inside Israel, because you've got so many that believe, just like Horowitz, that Netanyahu is destined to leave.
Where would you send people for more information, Brent?
I think people can read our sister publication's article from Watch Jerusalem by Warren Reich. It's called "The Danger in Division."
Thank you for that, Brent. We will link to that article in our show notes, "The Danger in Division." Over to Asia now, a historic development in the trade partnership between Europe and Asia this week. Some are comparing this to the opening of the Suez Canal. To learn about this, we will go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, an enormous Chinese freight train recently passed through the Marmaray Tunnel in Turkey on its way to the heart of Europe. And this was possible thanks to the opening of an infrastructure project that is so important that, as you said there, it is being compared to the Suez Canal. So the Marmaray Tunnel is about 8.5 miles long, and it runs under the sea, under the Bosporus Strait. So this tunnel really links the Asian part of Istanbul to the European side of Istanbul. Istanbul is one of the world's few transcontinental cities. And sultans over the Ottoman Empire, more than 100 years ago, dreamed of having a tunnel through the Bosporus, but it really remained just a pipe dream, maybe a hookah dream, up until 2004, when a Turkish-Japanese consortium started to actually build this tunnel. And it is a marvel of engineering. It's the world's deepest undersea immersed tube tunnel, and it was made with a really remarkable earthquake-proof technology, these links that make it be able to withstand earthquakes of up to a magnitude of 9, wow, which is just a massive a massive quake there. And this tunnel actually opened to passenger traffic back in 2013, but it remained disconnected from the railroad network up until just a few weeks ago. And while it was disconnected, trains would actually have to take ferries across the Bosporus. So that was just a colossal interruption in shipments. But now the tunnel has finally been connected to the rail network on both sides of the Bosporus, so it's really bridging the gap there in a dramatic way. And the analyst Jeffrey Aronson wrote about this a couple of days ago, actually on December 6th, and he called the tunnel and the connecting railways the, quote, "Suez Canal of our era." So the Suez, of course, was a really colossal development, slashing shipment times between India and Europe by weeks. And now the new Marmaray Tunnel is doing the same thing in another part of the world. And it does reduce train travel time between China and Western Turkey from 30 to 12 days. Mm. So just a really dramatic reduction there. And then if trains want to keep on going all the way to the, you know, for example, to Prague in the Czech Republic, which apparently is a big train hub, that now requires just about 18 days, which is half the time that it used to take, and it's or half the time rather that it would take by ship to mm-hmm. to get products to the to those locations, and it costs about the same amount as it would to ship them. And I've got an interesting quote here from Hu Heping. He's the secretary general of one of the Chinese Communist Party's main provincial committees. He led a delegation of Chinese authorities that went to Istanbul to actually watch this Chinese train kind of pioneer the way through the tunnel there. And he said, quote, "This journey will contribute immensely to the development of commercial and economic relations between Asia and Europe. We are witnessing a historic moment." So when you consider just how much time is being slashed by this infrastructure development, I think it's easy to see that he's exactly right.
The trade relationship between Asia and Europe is one that we watch closely for prophetic reasons. If you wouldn't mind, maybe you could just talk about the broader effort that China has made with the Belt and Road Initiative that this is a huge part of. There's definitely something that China has been working on multiple fronts, and then put that in the prophetic context for us, why that trade relationship is so significant.
Sure, yeah. The Chinese are branding this tunnel crossing and just the integration of the tunnel into the railroad networks as a big victory for the Belt and Road Initiative. That's the project that, as you said, we've spoken about many times. It's really championed as Chinese President Xi Jinping's number one, kind of his flagship foreign policy priority. Its basic aim is to rebuild the ancient Silk Road trade routes, but actually to go far beyond what they ever had anciently, and just to develop all sorts of ports and bridges and roadways and railways, as we see in this example. And he thinks that if China can build all of those things to better connect all of the nations in Asia and Europe and Africa to China, then it will basically end up giving China dominance over world trade. And the Belt and Road Initiative is, well, if it goes as planned, it'll link about 60% of the total global population. It'll span three continents, plus it's designed to have kind of a natural extension into Latin America. And at an estimated cost of $5 trillion, it is the most ambitious infrastructure venture, really, in history. So this Marmaray Tunnel is a part of that. It's really a vital part of those efforts to connect China and Europe. And in that context, you can see how important it is. But really, the main reason this is so significant, as you alluded to there, is just because prophecies that God inspired to be written in the Bible thousands of years ago say that a trade block will emerge in the end time between Asia and Europe. There's a passage in Isaiah 23 that calls this a mart of nations. And the chapter there lists ancient names for China, for Europe, even for Japan, which actually played a big role in the Marmaray Tunnel. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about all of these names. He proves their modern identities in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision. So it really walks through all of that. And he shows that this trade bloc will operate to the detriment of the United States. I'll read a quote from his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. It says, "The Bible contains many prophecies of that European power attacking America, and many other prophecies of America being besieged. China and the giants of Asia will form a brief alliance with the European bloc. All of them are going to besiege America, Britain, and the Jewish nation." So that's from Isaiah's End Time Vision. And really, the significance of China's Belt and Road Initiative, including this new route through the Marmaray Tunnel there, is revealed in those prophecies. And I think that booklet just does an excellent job of showing why it's so important.
Well, you can access that by actually looking at an article that Jeremiah has written on this specific subject, China Opens Suez Canal of Our Era. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's also available there on the front page of thetrumpet.com right now. Very important story. Jeremiah, we appreciate you bringing that to us. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a very condemning expose of America's failed war in Afghanistan, and a couple of warnings from politicians, one from Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, the other from one of our senators here in Oklahoma, James Lankford. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Washington Post just published a devastating report revealing nearly two decades of government documents about the war in Afghanistan. To learn more about this, we will turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
These documents were acquired over the past couple of years after the Washington Post used a Freedom of Information Act to get them, and they basically went through interviews that the different United States defense officials, government officials had over the past, let's say, decade, revealing the truth about what was really going on in Afghanistan, how bad the situation is there, whether the United States was actually having and the coalition was having success in Afghanistan or not. And the picture that was presented often as these documents lay out, also the public picture that was presented often, is that there was progress being made in the war in Afghanistan against the Taliban. The Taliban, of course, were in cahoots with Al-Qaeda, that was helping out Osama bin Laden, who was the mastermind behind the September 11th attacks. And at the time, after the September 11th attacks, the United States wanted blood for what had happened, understandably, and President Bush said that radical Islam and those radical Islamic terrorists were to blame, and decided as the first stop off on this war against terrorism to start off with Afghanistan and going against the Taliban. And as this war has progressed, and as these documents bring out, while there might have been moments of successful strategy here or there, the fundamental policies of the United States to try and win this war against the Taliban and try and then set up a government and a nation that would be stronger than to withhold a future Taliban attack has dismally failed at every turn over the past, 18 years.
Yeah, the picture that you get from these documents really shows just how impossible building a nation is the way that the United States has done it and or tried to do it, and just all of the conflicting elements of American strategy, the various goals that they were aiming to accomplish. There it's just absolutely impossible for a nation to do this, and yet we've sunk an enormous amount of resources, 2,400 lives lost into this effort. Maybe you could just talk about some of the difficulties that America has faced before we talk about, say, some of the deceit involved that is exposed in these documents, the impossibility of nation building.
Yeah, well, as you said, some of these facts and figures are astounding. Over 2,000 dead United States citizens, fighters. That on top of that, 63,000 Afghanis have died, 40,000 Taliban, and then another 63 that were fighting on behalf of the United States, or at least against the Taliban. And then you have $1 trillion that was spent in this war, $1 trillion that was spent in fighting this war. And then you have the $160 billion aid package that was given to try and build up Afghanistan. That's not included in the fighting. And this was extremely dangerous, this amount of money throwing at a state that didn't know how to govern itself. This is more than the Marshall Plan, more factored in with inflation that was rebuilding Western Europe after World War II, was given to a country, the country of Afghanistan. And these papers bring out that there was American officials that were sent over there in provinces that had $1 million a day to spend, and they didn't know what to do with this money. And as the documents bring out, this created an incredible amount of corruption inside this, what the government that America was trying to establish. The government officials were already largely corrupt, so how do you make corruption worse? Give them more money. And then there is less incentive to actually to fix the situation, because the longer the war is perpetuated, the more money that they get. And so you had actually had Afghani commanders that were pocketing lots of money throughout this war, to the point that you were perpetuating itself because of all this money. Now, the United States also wanted to try and stop the opium trade coming out of Afghanistan. They've spent $18 billion specifically on that. $18 billion. And last year was the worst year for opium production, or let's say the best year for opium production in Afghanistan. Afghanistan last year produced 82% of the world's opium. And that's after the United States has tried to put a stop to that. Now, what also happened is you have Afghanis that are defected from the pro-government forces because they see that their overlords are corrupt. And so because the leaders are corrupt, the people therefore don't want to submit to that corruption. And so you've had this idea that you can come in, fight the bad guys, prop up the government, build it up, throw lots of money at it, and it's going to work. And at the end of the day, it has actually gotten worse.
Let's talk about the deceit involved and the attempts to, as you said, to make things look better than they were. This really strikes a blow at whatever public trust there was in the government at a time when it's already suffering very low confidence. But anyone who digs into this story that the Post has put together here, this is irrefutable level of deceit and corruption on the part of the government.
Yeah, I mean, of course you want to try and paint it as it's being victorious for all the lives that are lost and the money's being spent. But the documents go in to show that behind closed doors, there was acknowledgement that the process was failing, that there wasn't a successful Afghan army being traded, and that the rulers in Iraq were knowingly, in Afghanistan, were knowingly corrupt, which is why you probably have the United States right now going around the back of the Afghani government itself to negotiate with the Taliban. But if I could just go through some public comments that were made, this in 2006, you had Rumsfeld, who was heading up a lot of the Afghanistan file for the Bush administration. He said that while it has become fashionable in some circles to call Afghanistan a forgotten war or to say the United States has lost its focus, the facts belie the myths. And then he went on to write how like people are getting better jobs, how the roads have become faster, how the nation is being built up, which was obviously in some ways true, but missing the picture of the rising body count that was taking place as well. 2008, you had Major General Jeffrey Schlosser saying that we are making steady progress. 2010, David Rodriguez, who was another higher army lieutenant general, he said we are making steady, deliberate progress. 2011, Petraeus said in the past 8 months we have seen important but hard-fought progress. 2012, the campaign is making significant progress under Panetta. 2016, we are seeing some progress. These are all different leaders over Afghanistan saying to the public, we are making progress. Republican administration, Democratic administration, back to Republican administration, saying progress was made, and yet there has been no progress, none, in Afghanistan at producing a country that can stand on its own 2 feet and all the while a country that has defeated the Taliban.
Anyone who's read The Trumpet over the years and the way that we've talked about this in light of Bible prophecy is not at all surprised. Put it in context for us.
Well, I really do want to encourage people, if they are listening to this, to go back and read what you wrote, in fact, back in 2001, first issue after the September 11th attacks. And then you wrote this during this article. It was entitled "The Head of the Snake." Can we know whether the U.S. campaign will be successful? We can. Bible prophecy gives the answer. And then you say you basically paint a dismal picture, saying that this isn't going to be successful, that this is actually going to be bad for the United States. You quote a scripture in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 19 and 20, that talk about how America's strength is going to be spent in vain, how the pride of America's power has been broken already, and nothing testifies to that more than the Afghan war, just looking at the money and the blood that is lost. And then you said this: understand, the Trumpet staff would like as much as anyone to see America conquer the war in the war on terrorism, but prophecy shows that as it is, regrettably, we're underestimating the enemy. If we take a dim view of the present U.S. efforts, it's because we know the Bible's stated outcome, and that is that this is not going to be a successful war. That was 18 years ago. How did we know? How do we know that the war and terrorism was going to be ineffectual by the United States and that this would be a quagmire like Vietnam based on these biblical prophecies found in Leviticus that refer to end-time Israel, of which the United States makes up a large part of that, and that God has broken the pride of our power and that we are under a curse? This isn't about failed strategy. This is about a curse from God that the superpower of the world cannot affect change in a country as small as Afghanistan, and not just affect change, but has actually made the situation worse.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. We will put a link to that article, The Head of the Snake, in the show notes for today's program. You can check that out under the Listen tab. Just go to the show hub for Trumpet Hour. When Narendra Modi recently won a landslide victory, we talked about how this would mean closer relations between India and Russia. Well, that's exactly what we are seeing, the latest evidence of which is a joint military exercise between these two nations. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia and India have just begun their 11th iteration of joint military exercises. These started on Wednesday, and they'll run through December 21st. And they're taking place in three Indian states: Goa, which is on the southwestern coast, and Maharashtra, there in the west of India, and also in Uttar Pradesh, which is in the north. And they'll also be pushing out into the Arabian Sea off the west coast of India for some naval aspects of the drills. So they're really covering a lot of ground all over India. And in these exercises, the militaries of Russia and India are using air, ground, and sea elements from both nations' forces. And the scale of it is substantial. I've not yet seen all the numbers published from the Indian side, but Russia has said that it is sending one of their Nustrashimi-class frigates, and also their Yelna tanker, and the Viktor Konetsky tugboat. They won't be able to send their sole aircraft carrier. There was actually a big accident with that earlier this week. It kind of caught on fire, and it'll be out of commission for quite a while. But to go with those warships, the Russians are sending 40 aircraft and more than 700 soldiers. So some pretty significant numbers there from the Russian side.
Could you put this in context with other signs of just how close Russia and India are becoming, and maybe even some historical context for us?
Sure, yeah. The Narendra Modi has played a big role in this. He became India's prime minister about 5.5 years ago, and he's long been, a close personal friend of Vladimir Putin. And India has always been, they were non-aligned during the Cold War. They tried to not choose a side there, and they've always had close ties with the Russians. But Modi has really ramped up India-Russia ties to a new level, and that's most evident, I think, in the weapons purchases that we see happening more and more, India buying Russian weaponry. In 2018, despite sanctions that the U.S. put on countries that may buy Russian weaponry, India bought Russia's really vaunted S-400 missile system. It's five battalions of the S-400 that were to be delivered to India over the next few years. So that was a major deal. That I think it was remarkable that India did that despite risks of isolation from the U.S., possibly even sanctions. So far, we've not seen any sanctions implemented as a result of that, but India showed that they were willing to risk possibly really damaging their relationship with the U.S. to make that deal go through. And then just in March of this year, India signed a $3 billion contract for some of Russia's Akula 1-class nuclear-powered attack submarines. So that was a 10-year contract to lease some of those. And we see these kinds of deals happening more and more. And it all comes at the, as I mentioned, just at the risk of infuriating the United States over these sanctions that are supposed to apply to any nation that buys Russian weaponry.
So where would you send people for understanding of why this is significant prophetically?
We have an article called "Largest Election in History Means India Will Turn Further Toward Russia." This is one that we wrote earlier this year when Narendra Modi was elected to really a landslide re-election for another five-year term. And that article goes through a lot of the Bible's prophecies about what is termed in Scripture the kings of the East. it's a massive Asian trade bloc that is set, you know, the scriptures say it'll come together in the end time. And there's a passage in Ezekiel 38 that says it'll be led by Russia. It gives ancient names for Russia, showing that that'll be the lead nation. But then if you go a little further in Ezekiel 38, verse 5 gives some ancient names for the peoples that make up modern-day India. So it says right there that India will be lumped into this Russia-led Kings of the East bloc. And that article there will really explain those scriptures and point to more substantial literature that'll go even deeper.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Angela Merkel is in her final days as German chancellor, and this week she did something very unusual for someone in her position. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so according to German media, Chancellor Angela Merkel sees that she's entering the twilight of her chancellorship. Not that she necessarily believes she's going to go tomorrow, but that from here on out, her kind of whole career is now going to be engulfed in, well, when are you going to go, and all of this kind of thing that just takes up the headlines. And there's one place she wanted to make sure she got to before that kind of twilight years or twilight of her chancellorship set in: Auschwitz. And so this time last week, she was visiting the concentration camp there, and she gave a speech there. And I think it's remarkable that she kind of made that effort that, you know, I want to make it to Auschwitz while I still can as chancellor. And one of the things that I think makes that remarkable is she was the first German leader to speak before the Knesset in Israel's parliament. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry really drew attention to that speech at the time, back in 2008. And he had a lot of praise for that speech. She got up there and she said that the mass murder of 6 million Jews carried out in the name of Germany has brought indescribable suffering to the Jewish people, Europe, and the entire world. And she said that Germans were filled with shame over the Holocaust. And Mr. Flurry called that the most significant speech made by any German leader since World War II. And he said that considering Germany's Nazi past, that speech should have grabbed world headlines. And he said, I personally have never heard such a repentant speech from a powerful world leader in my life. So that was 2008. And so I think it's interesting that she wanted to make sure she went to Auschwitz right at the end of her chancellorship. And it was kind of a similar speech. She got up there. She said, I'm deeply ashamed of the barbaric crimes perpetrated here by Germans. But she did more than just kind of talk about shame or apologize. She talked about the importance for Germany to remember this history and to memorialize this history. She said, remembering the crimes, naming the perpetrators, giving the victims a dignified commemoration, this is a responsibility that does not end. It is not negotiable, and it is inseparable from our country. She spoke about out against the revisionism of history. She quoted an Auschwitz survivor who said, it has happened, consequently, it can happen again. And she said, this story must be told over and over again so that we may remain alert, so that such crimes cannot be repeated in any way. And I think that's remarkable. You've got the German chancellor right now saying that Germans must remain alert so that such crimes must not be repeated. And Deutsche Welle pointed out how out of tune this message is with some parts of modern Germany. Right. They said for several years now, calls have been getting louder for Germany to let the past become history, for the country to finally stop being preoccupied with this historic guilt. And Angela Merkel came with a very different message, saying, no, we can never let that happen. We really need to hold on to this history, to keep it before our eyes so that we don't repeat it.
Well, the difference between her speech and that response, that this is out of touch with the sentiment in modern Germany, is really interesting given the rise in anti-Semitism that has been evident in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. It seems like in many ways Merkel's speech is more needed now than ever.
And yeah, she acknowledged that in her speech. And yes, you've seen violent attacks, anti-Semitic attacks in Germany are up 60%. You're seeing people making statements now in Germany's House of Parliament, basically, that would have caused scandal years ago. You know, you're seeing the alternative for Deutschland has become a major party now in Germany, kind of vying with some of these other parties to be the second or third most powerful party. And you've got leaders doing exactly that, talking of minimizing the Holocaust, saying, well, it's just, you know, it's just a minor imperfection on Germany's glorious history. We need to stop remembering it, stop building memorials. it is really out of touch with what's happening in Germany. And I think that makes her message all the more powerful. And her message really exposes something that we've been talking about for years, that the Nazi spirit in Germany. Well, that Mr. Flurry said this in that article that I mentioned after that 2008 speech. The Nazi spirit is very much alive in Germany. It's time we woke up. And Angela Merkel's speech, those statistics on anti-Semitism, what you see going up in Europe, that reveals that. And the Bible prophesied, Revelation 17, talks about an empire in Europe that rises up and then it disappears from the scene. It goes underground. That Nazi spirit is hidden. And then it comes back up again later. And Miss Merkel's speech, I think, exposes that reality in Europe.
Richard wrote about this subject for a Trumpet brief earlier this week. The title of that, Angela Merkel's Final Warning to Germany. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, as well as Gerald Fleury's article, Angela Merkel's Historic Holocaust Speech, the one from 2008. An important one to review, given her recent comments. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll finish the show with another warning, this from our own Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. This regards America's monumental debt. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
For the past 5 years, Senator Lankford has published a report titled Federal Fumbles. It highlights wasteful spending in the U.S. government. His most recent report came out this Monday, and he made some comments about it, highlighting that America's been collecting more tax revenue than at any time in its history, and yet is still drowning in debt. It collected $3.33 trillion in taxes last year and managed to spend $4.11 trillion. So that bumped up your total government debt up to around $23 trillion. And he makes the comment, he says that we're approaching a time where it would take the income of every single person in America for the entire year to be collected in taxes to pay off our debt. These kind of numbers can't be sustained, and everyone quietly knows it in the back of their mind. And so he makes a good point there, that this is something that, well, unfortunately, not everyone in America. There are a few on the radical left that think this type of spending can be sustained. But most people, hopefully most people, know that you can't keep running deficits like this forever and not come to ruin. But it's just kind of one of those, well, not this year. Mm-hmm. Type things. He highlights in the report $383 billion in wasteful spending. He had a couple examples, like a $2 million the American government spent on sea lions in Russia, $500 million it spent to rent tents instead of buying them for illegal immigrants on the southern border, a 600,000 documentary on the Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. It doesn't say whether it was for or against Joseph Stalin, and part of me doesn't want to know the answer to that question. But even that, this $383 billion in wasteful spending is kind of a drop in the bucket compared to the extent of the deficits you're running each year. So not only do you need to get rid of that wasteful spending, you really need to cut down things that some people think aren't wasteful to get this down to a sustainable economic model, which is what the Bible says you should have. It's actually in Deuteronomy 28, God lists blessings and cursings for a nation. And one of the blessings is that if you are a blessed nation, if God is blessing you, you shall lend money to many nations and you shall not borrow. And so obviously America is borrowing much, 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 much more than it lends these days. And so you take the Bible at its word there. They're definitely not receiving that blessing. They're receiving a curse. And there's an important reason why. We can put in the show notes the actual article you wrote entitled "The Biggest Threat to America's National Security" that goes through just why this big government debt, which is quite a bit higher now than when that article was written, is such a threat to America.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah and to Steve Herkus for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. So obstinately contradictory is man that you cannot compel him to his advantage, yet he yields before everything that forces him to his hurt. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.